K2RIW here. Finally, sorry about that. Okay, at this time, Mel and Dick, again the TechNet. TechNet number 1145 of the series that began in September of 1982. For those who haven't signed into the TechNet before or heard about it before, its major purpose is to answer people's questions, usually about ham radio, but not necessarily. Any subject of interest to ham radio operators, and you know who those guys are. That's a scientist wrapped up in the body of a ham radio operator. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. And the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So we have a chicken at this time. Please give me your call letters and name.
This is KC2QYW. The name is Joe, and it's a yes.
We got Joe. Anyone else?
WS2N. Paul, and no questions at this time, Dick.
Okay, Paul recognized, our space expert. He'll have a question later on. You wait and see. We got Joe and Paul. Who else?
W2BIE. Good evening, Dick. No questions. Have a good evening, sir.
There's a man who's going to have a question. You wait and see. Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Don't know who that is. Some guy named Mel. Alrighty. Anyone else? Let's see. There's no football game. I don't know what's going on tonight. Hey, Joe. You're gonna have everything. Take your time. KC2QYW. Go right ahead with your question. In fact, you better give us two questions, Joe.
Roger, Roger. I want to say hi to the net and everybody out there at the net. Hi, Dick and Mel. Yes. I tried out that website. It was great. Amateurradio.tv. It was great. Okay. My question is. Alright, there's two radios out here that I want to pick, and I'm not sure which one. The ICOM 718 or the DX77C. I believe it's made by Linco, a line co or something like that. And that's one of my questions. And my second question is, I really don't want to build an antenna. Is there an antenna out there that sells a little bit of everything that I could purchase?
An antenna that does a little bit of everything. You don't want to purchase an antenna. Okay. Once you get a hold of the ARRL antenna book, antenna handbook, I think it costs $20, but you'll find in there a tremendous number of antennas that can be homebrewed. For 2 meters, you've got antennas that can be made out of coat hanger wire as a Yagi structure using a SO239. That's the female chassis mount UHF connector. You can build a ground plane out of one of those, again with coat hanger wire or 14 gauge house wire. So a couple of dollars worth of hardware allow you to build an antenna of 4 or 5 different kinds out of that handbook. So one of the choices you're going to have to make is 2 meter FM your only kind of operation? FM radio, handy talkies and repeaters and things like this, that ham radio is primarily vertically polarized, so be careful on that one. In other words, the transmitter is vertical, the receiver is vertical, and you would assume everything in between is vertically polarized, straight up and down. You would think a ground plane antenna is the right way to go. A ground plane antenna mounted on the chimney of the house will give you a lot of performance, and even if you're using radial RG58 cables, or more quality RG8 cable, or even hardline, or whatever, to feed to it. But the altitude on 2 meters counts so much, the loss of the line is secondary. The gain of the antenna is secondary. If you want to get kind of serious about antennas, you can build a Yagi antenna. It would only be a couple of pounds and a couple of dollars. And with a television rotator, you can now rotate that Yagi north, south, east, and west, and decide which one of the repeaters you want to go to, which one you want to reject, and how much DX you want to get. They get 2 or 3 times the range for the Yagi as opposed to a a simple vertical antenna on the house. The Aggies in the car is something that I've experimented with, and that's more difficult. And a vertically polarized Yagi, not difficult. If you want the ability to talk to the guys on 2 meter single sideband, they gather around 144.200, and that's another very different group compared to the FM people, even though they're in the same band. Very different philosophy of life. They get a little bit more into the technical. They get a hell of a lot more range. A single sideband, high performance transmitter receiver on the sideband portion of the band with 100 watts of output and a Yagi on the roof of the house will get you numbers like 200 and 300 and 400 miles almost every single day of the summer, and two-thirds of that difference in distance in the winter. Tremendous improvement in range for single sideband. But it's a little slightly different kind of operation. A little more careful tuning is required to make the voice sound right. And horizontal polarization, what they use, primarily Yagi. But not only. Vertical polarization with a Yagi is doable. The Yagi you're listening to right now, the one that I'm using on the top of my tower, is not horizontal and it's not vertical. It's slanted at a 45 degree angle in polarization. In other words, the boom of the Yagi is parallel to the ground, but I've rotated that boom in its mounting structure so that it's a 45 degree angle to the ground, every one of the elements. That makes me halfway between the horizontal people and the vertical people, so I talk to both of them. But as I said earlier, be careful about judging polarization. When I used to be making lots of trips up to the Rome Air Development Center near Utica in New York on the thruway, starting at Long Island, I had a horizontally polarized mag mount antenna on the car. It was a square loop, MC square loop, and I had a vertically polarized 5/8 wave whip, two feed lines coming into the car, and a simple relay in the car where I could flip back and forth between the two in a fraction of a second. So, with the whip antenna is the one I used the most of the time. I was talking to a guy in southern New Jersey who is running a pretty high gain antenna and a kilowatt of power on sideband at 2 meters. And I would talk to him from southern New Jersey as I drove all the way up to Utica, 200 mile airline distance between us. And I had 90% copy on him and him on me. I was running a 180 watt amplifier in the car. And throughout most of that trip, I could flip back and forth between horizontal and vertical, and he sounded the same, even though he's transmitting horizontal. Because when that signal sips through the trees, gets reflected by the buildings and the hills and everything else, as you're going along the New York State Thruway, there was essentially no polarization left. Until I got to a scenic overlook where I could see 20 or so miles. Now, the horizontal polarization was, you know, 15 dB louder than the vertical. But when you're down at the roadbed altitude, polarization is not all you think it is. So even if you have a horizontally polarized Yagi on the chimney of your house, don't let that stop you from trying to talk to the vertically polarized station. You may have to orient the antenna a little bit differently in azimuth when you've had your rotator running. Polarization is very different than you would think. When I'm listening to my handy talkie and I put it on the shelf in the bathroom while I'm shaving in the morning, there's something about the way the signal reflected around my house that this repeater and quite a few of the repeaters in the Queens area are strongest horizontally polarized. I lay the handy talkie horizontal on that shelf, that wooden shelf in my bathroom. It's actually a plastic shelf. And when I set the radio vertical, the signal is nowhere near as loud and gets a phase and dropout. So antennas are a lot of fun to play with, Joe. You read the good books on the subject. There's lots of different kinds of antennas you can homebrew. You can buy them if you want to. If you're a guy that just likes to write a check and make the problem go away, that's acceptable. But it's a lot more fun to experiment with them and build them yourself when they're so inexpensive. And you can't go wrong. If you build a really bad antenna that has a high standing wave ratio on 2 meters, almost every 2 meter rig, whether it be a mobile type or a base station type, are very rugged. You can put them into a dead short circuit or an open circuit for a considerable period of time and not damage anything 98% of the time. So you can't build a bad antenna. It's not going to explode, it's not going to catch on fire, and it's not going to kill your rig. Worst that'll happen is you won't get the performance you want. You'll get on the air with what little performance you've got, you'll get on the tech net, you'll describe what's going on, and Mel and Vic will say, well, you do this and you do that, and it's going to get better. Just give us the symptoms as to what problems you're having. So antennas are a fun thing to put, experiment with. Not expensive, you get a lot of performance and a lot of good enjoyment in the learning process. In the days that Mel and Dick first cut their teeth on ham radio, back in the 50s, there were very few 2-meter rigs you could buy. You had a homebrew, you had a modified taxi cab rig, or a piece of commercial or military equipment. You had to really get into the guts of the transmitter and the receiver to make it work on this band. That has changed so much now that every rig you and I are likely to use from 1980 on has got a frequency synthesizer. Most of them nowadays have surface mount components, high density integrated circuits. As such, to build your own rig is out of the question, with rare exceptions. To build an amplifier, maybe, particularly a kilowatt amplifier. But the transmitter, the receiver, you don't build that. The microphone, you don't build that. The transmission line, you don't build that. The tower, maybe you could build that. The antenna, yeah. Now, there's where construction is left. When it comes to choosing brand A, brand B, or brand C rig, there, Mel and Vic are not going to give you much help. Talk to your buddies, get their testimonials. Some of them like brand A. I mean, the big three, Yaesu, Kenwood, ICOM, and I'm a little bit worried about Kenwood. I'm hearing stories about the fact that Kenwood is giving up ham radio and going into marine and commercial and whatever, but apparently they're not making enough profit out of ham radio. In a way, I can see how it happens. They haven't been treating the hams quite as well as they should when it comes to service. You call up Belleville, Washington, the telephone number for ICOM, and you say, I'm having trouble with my model so-and-so handy-talkie, and the rubber pad on the front where the touch tone numbers are printed on it, I think I need another one of those because they're all rubbed away. Well, they'll tell you exactly what the part number is. They'll look it up for you. They'll mail it to you and bill you. They trust you that you're going to send them the money back. They're very service-oriented. And so people who love ICOM just love the service they get there. When it comes to Kenwood, it was much more difficult to get parts. Yaesu is somewhere in between. So that's what we can tell you about general brand names. And when it comes to individual model numbers, your biggest variable is which one are you running into at your particular flea market if you want to save money. Okay, you open up the book, and it's very hard to buy a bad one if you're buying one of the major brands. They all have features that are kind of nice. The thing that I worry about much is most is user-friendliness. Some very smart guys will occasionally show up at the major flea markets like Timoney in Maryland or Horse Traders in New Hampshire. And some of these major flea markets, guys will show up selling you a little white card, which is a crib sheet, a cheat sheet. In other words, they'll tell you where in the menus of your particular handy-talkie are the commands you're looking for, because it's not obvious in the front panel. The fact that you can buy those cards, the fact that people need those cards, tell me right away that user-friendliness is nowhere near what it should be. You look at the spec sheet in the advertising book, or in QSP, CQ, ham radio. You look at the ham radio is not there anymore. You know what I mean. CQ 73, I think 73 may not even be there anymore. But you look at the major books, or the advertisements from the vendors of these pieces of equipment, and you go down the list and you say, gee, this one costs $171, and this one costs $179, and this one has 19 features, and this one has 21 features. And you start comparing things like that, and the manufacturer must think that people use that as a criteria for which one they're going to buy. And in some cases, that's the wrong criteria. The one with 21 features may be twice as difficult to program as the one with 15 features. And so, how many times have you heard somebody on 2-meter FM mobile ham radio, and someone says, gee, I'm going over to frequency so-and-so, and the guy in the mobile says, I can't get there, I'm driving. If I pull over to the side, and if I open up the manual that's in the glove compartment, maybe I'll be able to reprogram it to that new frequency you're going to. But it's going to take me 5 minutes to do that. you take your old-fashioned 1985 IC2AD handy-talkie, which has got some wheel switches. I can drive the car. I don't have to take my eyes off the road. I can flip that thumb wheel switch because I know I'm on 146.85 and the guy wants me to go to 9.2. That means I take the middle thumb wheel switch and click it one click, and I take the right-hand thumb wheel switch and click it three clicks in the other direction. I don't have to take my eyes off the road. My fingers tell me what I'm doing. The old-fashioned simple rigs were easy to program, and we've lost a lot of that, and I really regret that. Yeah, you can get some of it back with some of the modern ones, which will have a verbal voice synthesizer, which will talk to you and say what frequency it's on, what mode it's in. And in some cases, you can press those buttons while you're driving the car and not take your eyes off the road. I strongly recommend nobody use a handy-talkie, a cell phone, or whatever, where you have to take your eyes off the road. You're a hazard to yourself and to the rest of the world out there if you're doing that. So some of the very simple rigs, the ones that you find in the flea market, I mean, I own four or five IC2ATs. I used to go to an event like a theme park with my family. I would hand one to each of my children, one to my wife. My son's got a license, my wife's got a license, I've got a license, my daughter doesn't. But we were looking over her shoulder, we're controlling the emissions, she's running in the low-power mode, and she was using a handy-talkie. So each one's got a handy-talkie, and at the appropriate time, I say, hey, folks, let's gather, it's 1:30, the crowd has slowed down, we can go to the lunch counter, we can all go eat together. And they're all scattered in this multi-acre park, and on the handy-talkies, I can call them all back together. That's what I was doing lots of years ago. So I got lots of handy-talkies, IC2ATs. Nowadays, you go to a flea market, you go to eBay, or you go to any other kind of an auction, you can probably buy a used IC2AT for $50, $40, in good working condition. And if it's not good working condition, a guy like Andy, WA2CDL, can get it in good working condition for you. You can't go wrong with something like that. Of the four or five IC2ATs I own, one of them has been dropped from the 100-foot level of my tower into the backyard. One of them, when I was doing some work on somebody else's tower, I was at the 80-foot level, and it was dropped hard onto macadam or asphalt. And it bounced and made a really ugly sound. And the battery in the bottom is the heavy part. That hit first, and the battery shattered. The rest of the rig kept working. To say that that thing is rugged is a drastic understatement. And that is the most reproduced piece of electronics that does radio transmitting and receiving on planet Earth. Something like 2.2 million of them have been produced. So if you want one, they're out there. And the only glitch they run into is there's one little resistor in there. It's a fusible resistor, which has got 0 ohms to it, which becomes a little bit intermittent. You replace that one resistor, and boy, those things fly. That's the only failure I've ever heard of those rigs ever producing. Other than that, boy, are they rugged. So as you can see, for Mel and I to select or suggest a particular brand of rig, boy, that's tough. It's almost as bad as if Mel and Dick told you you really should marry a red-headed lady who is of Italian background. Well, that's our particular opinion. When it comes to choosing a wife or when it comes to choosing a rig, in either case, the number of variables is huge, and if you're a sufficiently adaptable person, there's a lot of them that are compatible with you, and it'll work. There's a lot of rigs you can become compatible with once you decide what you're looking for. And don't try to get all the horns and whistles. Try to get something that's easy to program is my suggestion. I'm going to turn it over to Mel because he's probably got a couple of suggestions as to which one to buy. He's not going to suggest a brand name. He's not going to suggest a model number. He's going to tell you what criteria for a rig you're looking for, whether it be used. And when it comes to saving money, boy, you're going to get a lot for your money when you buy a used one. K2KEY, tell Joe a couple of suggestions as to how he should go buy his next rig. K2RIW, the tech man.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Good evening to all. And Joe, I think you asked about one particular radio. I think you said something about ICOM. Did you say 718? Over.
Yeah, Roger. IC 718. And also, there's a website out there. I don't know if you guys ever heard of it. They tell you all the reviews of the radios out there. I think it's QRD.com. So when I have time during the week, I'll read up some reviews on these radios.
Yeah, to answer your question, yes, it's IC-718.
Okay, now, 718 is a HF-only radio. Is that the one you're referring to? Because I happen to have a 718 in a mobile. That's my mobile radio. Reason I chose that because it has a very large display. And as Dick said, it's one of the newer versions, but a simple radio to operate that you really don't have to take your eyes off the road to use it. I mean, the display is very big, so you can just glance at it every so often if you want to know what frequency you're on. And the number of controls on the front panel are minimized. It's a 100-watt HF rig, and I've done very well with it. I've worked 100 countries from the mobile with it. Now, are you talking about that radio, strictly HF radio? And we would like to know something about that, Joe. Over.
Yeah, Roger. That's the one, the HF. And I'm going to only use it for base, for a home base station.
Okay. If you want a basic radio, HF radio, simple HF radio, extremely good, price is right. I would even look for a second-hand one because they are I believe, about the cheapest HF radio that ICOM has on their market right now, and it comes with the DSP. They throw that in, and it's for even as a base radio. I honestly will say it's a nice intermediate radio because it's not too small and it's not too large, so it fits perfectly comfortable in the mobile, and at the same time also is very comfortable at the home station. It is a radio that easily, if you want to get the so-called deep wet in HF radio, this is the radio to buy, Joe. You can't go wrong with it. The receiver on it is excellent. It's very similar to when I used the 703, the ICOM 703, which is the QRP radio, the receiver on it, has a very similar characteristic to that receiver, which happens to be an excellent little radio. So if you're looking for a 718, I go no further. It's, like I say, it's just an underrated radio, very underrated, and at its price, I have never heard anybody so far knock a Joe over.
WW.
Okay, I guess I'm going to stir up a little controversy here. Let me turn it back to Dick. You take the controversy, Dick. I knew this was going to happen.
Hey, Roger, Roger.
All right, W, detect that, K2KEY.
Okay, I heard both Rich and HW, Howie. Rich first, into Rio, go right ahead, Rich, with your comments.
Okay, Dick, as you know, I used to be in the services business. I choose all of them. I think you ought to take an attention to Jupiter. Without the antenna tuner, it's like $1,200. With the tuner, which will match 2-to-1, the city was about 15 units.
Okay, that's one of your favorites. Let's see what Howie's got to say. We'll be doing HWW. Go ahead, Howie.
I'm not going to tell you a name brand, but what I'm going to say is that people should listen to Dick. Don't look for a radio with all the frills. Look for a radio that has a good front end and a good receiver. Anybody can put digital features into a radio, especially in VHF and UHF. Look for a radio that's not going to get in a mod. Some of your older gear have a better receiver. That's all I was going to say. And another thing is, go look at a radio. Play with your friend's radio. See if you like it. Give it a test drive. Don't just look at the ads. And, you know, before you go out, pick the radio you want and then shop for it. You know, use somebody else's radio. Go to your friend's shack. But at the end of the day, get a radio that has a good front end. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. Yeah, I like simple, basic. I'm from old school, guys. I like big stuff. I like big buttons. And I like easy operation and basic operation. Roger, back to you, Dick.
We want a good front end.
Yeah, one of the nice things to do, I wish Field Day hadn't already happened, Joe. By way of the ARRL website for Long Island, you could get the list of all of the sites where people are going to be holding field day. And starting on Saturday morning and ending at Sunday evening, you could, if you're really enthusiastic, go to 10 of those different locations where people are running field day. And there you'll see a lot of very reliable equipment in continuous operation. Guys who bring their field day radio down want to make sure it's something that anybody can sit down at that particular table in front of that particular radio and be able to use it without needing an hour's worth of instruction as to where the mode switch is and where the push-to-talk switch and how do you move the frequency and how do you change bands and so on. So when it comes to very solid, reliable radios, visiting a field day site, multiple field day sites will give you a lot of information. And most likely you'll be asked to sit down and operate the radio too. You'll get real hands-on experience, or at least talk to the guy that's standing on line who's going to use the rig next, if you know what I mean. The next best thing you can do is go to some of these VHF locations, the June and the September contest and the August contest. With a little bit of searching, you can find out where those guys gather and look at that particular rig. Flea markets are another good place where you'll see a lot of things on benches, but there it's usually not in operating a situation because the power is not there, unless it's battery operated. So by way of testimonials, by way of field day sites and so on, you can get a lot of exposure, which is one step beyond what you get by reading a website or reading a set of reviews. The set of reviews will tell you technical specs. They'll tell you the man who did the review, what his opinions are. And that's helpful, but still, in the case of QST Magazine brand new equipment review, the slight problem you got there is the reviewer is a little bit on the positive side, because potentially that particular rig is one of their advertisers. So if there's some really terrible condition, it'll be described to you, but it'll be described in what's the word I'm looking for now, diplomatic language. You'll have to read through the words, so to speak, to find out what the glitch is with that particular rig. It's a little bit hard to find out where the glitches are when you read the reviews in the magazine that are using that vendor as an advertiser. And even if there is a negative report, most likely the negative report is a temporary condition that exists for the first production run, and if they want to keep them, they want to stay in business, they'll get rid of that because hams are very good at talking to each other and saying, gee, I like the so-and-so rig, but boy, this one characteristic it's got just drives me up a wall. And people start passing that word around, and pretty soon a large number of guys are voting with their pocketbook, and if they don't fix that rig, it's not going to sell very well. So most of these bad conditions are temporary. There's only one particular piece of equipment of all of my years of ham radio. 1956, I'm the first licensed, so that makes me 41 years. And I've bought lots and lots of used equipment. I've only gotten one real lemon. My definition of a lemon was a particular model number of rig. It was a 2-meter, all-mode, single sideband capable rig. And that particular production run of about 50 radios, the guys doing the manufacture did not, on the printed circuit boards, wash away the rosin. In other words, there's a whole washing process after it's been through the solder flow machine that solders all the components down. They didn't wash away the rosin that was used for that solder flow operation. And the rosin kept eating its way into the integrated circuit and into the variable capacitors. And so that rig had no less than about 15 individual components that started becoming intermittent. And I started replacing the ones that were failing, and I pretty soon realized there was a lot of them, and it's more to follow. I had to abandon that rig. That's an extremely rare situation. Other than that, whenever you buy a used piece of equipment, even if it's known to be in non-working order, if you've got access to people who can do repair, you'd be amazed what bargains you can get. Because 98% of all the parts to make that rig are inside of that cabinet. The most expensive part of the old-fashioned rigs was the power transformer, and the second most expensive part is the output stage transistor. And those are a very small fraction of the price of the whole rig, and they're quite replaceable. And so, as I've said so many times before, even a rig that's been thrown down a flight of stairs and the front panel is dented, that could be an extremely good bargain rig, because it doesn't have to pass the beauty contest for you to be happy with the way it operates. And so I can think of one other intermittent I had with a particular rig which had a optical shaft encoder for the main frequency dial, and that became a little bit flaky. But had I been willing to take it apart and clean up those light-emitting diodes that are in there and the photo detectors, I'm pretty sure even that could have been fixed. So with access to the right kind of repair people, it's very difficult to find a true lemon. Maybe with used automobiles, you occasionally get a lemon. But with used ham radio equipment of known good brand names, I mean, if you want to listen to a testimony, you'll tell me that it's very difficult to find a used Kenwood TS711A. That's what you're listening to right now. Very difficult to find a bad one. My favorite 2-meter all-mode rig. It's not compact, but it's quite easy to use. It's only got 30 memories, doesn't have all the horns and whistles, but it's got all modes, it's got a very solid front end. Howie would be happy with the fact that it's difficult to overload this front end. This is the rig that you might be able to bring to the Empire State Building and still make use of those, even though there's a zillion kilowatt transmitters nearby that's going to overload the average rig. Only puts out 30 watts, but another thing I like about it is on the front panel, there is a knob that adjusts the power output. I turn it to the left, I can go down to 1 watt. I turn it to the right, I can go up to 30 watts of output. So when I'm feeding transceivers and other amplifiers, some of my amplifiers want 10 watts, some of them want 15 watts, some of them want 5 watts, I can dial in the amount of power out of this rig to drive the afterburner of the transverter. If I was going into a 2-meter to 432 transmitting converter, and it wants a particular amount of drive power, I've got that selectable on the front panel. To me, that's an extremely nice feature, and that's rare as all heck. I don't know of any other rig that's got that. There may be one or two out there. It's just a feature that I like. Okay. You heard lots of opinions. You maybe got a couple more questions about antennas. I may have been a little bit left of center in what I told you about antennas. So you got the floor, Joe. KC2QIW. And you might tell me where Harrison, New York is. I don't know. K2IW, the tech man.
Okay. This is KC2QIW. This is for ID. The name is Joe over here. To answer your first question, Harrison, New York is in Westchester County. Have you ever heard of Rye Playland? The very popular park out there called Rye Playland. In Rye, it's, Harrison is the next town over. And Harrison's also, it's near White Plains, New York, and Mamaroneck. I have no more questions, but I just want to say hi to everybody out there, and you guys are doing a really good job. Yeah, I would like to build my own antenna, but I have such a busy lifestyle nowadays with the kid and the family and everything. I'm probably going to have to go the other route. I'm going to probably have to buy one for the ESF in the future. Back to the net. I'll pass it back to you guys.
There's a couple of people who want to make comments, but I guess I misunderstood. Since you're on 2 meters, I thought you wanted to build a 2-meter antenna. When it comes to HF antennas, lots of people on this repeater are going to tell you that when it comes to a simple wire dipole, it is higher in performance than 90% of the antennas you can buy. Let me repeat that. A simple wire dipole, you take 14-gauge, 16-gauge household wire, the right number of feet of it with egg insulators on the end, with some polypropylene rope beyond that, shoot it up into a tree with a bow and arrow or a slingshot, or mount it to a telephone pole or to the chimney of the house, make it as a sloper. A simple dipole at a reasonable altitude is going to give you more performance than 80 or 90% of the antennas that you can buy. It's very easy to open up a book and see these very fancy-looking vertical ground plane antennas with all kinds of fancy coils and chokes and doodads on there, and it just looks like $1 million. And it's made for multiple bands. And so, gee, you buy this one antenna, you spend $300 for it, you install it in the backyard, it goes on the ground, doesn't need any altitude, and it gets you on all bands at once. Boy, that sounds attractive, except for the price. And then you start digging into the particulars. It needs a whole lot of ground plane wires that the manufacturer doesn't tell you about, because that would discourage you from buying it. And without a whole lot of ground plane radios, you don't get much performance. And even when you put in the ground plane radios, the antenna is on the ground. It has very little altitude. If you're in a very flat terrain in the Mojave Desert of California, that will work pretty well. If you're in a place like Harrison, near Mamaroneck, where you've got buildings and trees and hills and all kinds of things nearby, you'll want some altitude. And so Mel and I have been hearing by our email and comments on the air. There are guys who have got a $300 antenna. They followed all the instructions. They went above and beyond installing it. And then as a comparison, they put a dipole in the backyard at a 30-foot altitude, and the dipole is giving them 5 and 10 dB more signal strength, and more people are hearing them. And they're saying, what in the world's going on? What's wrong with my antenna? So be careful you don't fall into that trap. Who is it that wanted to make some further comments to Joe? I heard you 2 transmissions ago starting to tell us who you were.
Here we are, Vic.
Rich recognized. Was there another person? Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I have some pretty strong opinions. Check out 10 TENTC.com. They don't make name association with a lot of the newer hams. They've been around a long time. They're in Fayetteville, Tennessee. They will give you a 30-day money-back trial on their rate. I think from what you're saying, you'll like Jupiter. With tuning is, I think, 15 and change. Or match 10 to 1. You've got a good solid seat. It's a very nice radio. As far as an antenna, the best thing I found, I agree, that halfway dipole, feed it with open wire pipe, and a tuner, you'll match all bands.
Now, when it comes to that dipole, to make it work on 5 bands at once, there are various designs with coils built into the middle of the wire to make it a multi-band trap dipole. That's one approach. Or you can say, the heck with that, we'll just go down to the real basics and make a fan dipole. In other words, on the center egg insulator, if you want 10, 15, 20, and 40 meters, you set up a dipole for 10 meters, bent off to a few degrees at angle, connected to the exact same egg insulator in parallel. You put up another dipole for 15 meters, a couple of degrees away from that, or a couple of feet away from that. You put another dipole for 20 meters, and so on. You know that each one of these dipoles, when they're fed the wrong frequency, they tend to have a very high standing wave ratio. That really means, in general, they act like an open circuit. So automatically, a fan dipole is a frequency-selective antenna. When you're on 15 meters, the signal will, 98% of the signal will pour down the 15-meter dipole, and it will reject all the 10-meter dipole and the 20-meter dipole, because those are open circuits at that frequency. So a fan dipole is inexpensive, and it covers all bands. If you're putting up enough bands to it, if you know what I mean. So it's a bunch of parallel wires, not quite parallel. And because of the other wires being present, you gotta, if you're a persnickety guy and you want to get the lowest possible standing wave ratio, the lengths of the dipoles have to be adjusted a couple of percent because of the nearby capacitance of the other dipoles. That's a simple operation. If you have some way of measuring standing wave ratio and you scan across the band, you make yourself a graph, and it'll be a bathtub-shaped curve, and where it hits the lowest standing wave ratio is where that dipole was resonant. And if the bottom of the bathtub is on the high end of the band, you know you're going to add a little wire and make it a little bit longer to bring it down in frequency, and vice versa. So it's a, and even if you don't do that, if you followed Rich's advice, Rich and Barry N2MD have done a lot of work with open wire lines fed into antenna tuners. One simple dipole, open wire fed, not even a fan dipole, with a good tuner, will get you onto all bands. The antenna tuner does all the matching for you, and you're resonating the radiating system. It doesn't matter if the dipole itself is resonant or if it's using the antenna tuner to establish some of the resonance. It doesn't matter as long as you got low enough loss in the feed line. And those guys have had rather simple antennas with extremely high performance, and because the antenna is so simple, light, and inexpensive. Getting it up high in the air with a slingshot is very easy, as long as you got nearby apartment buildings, trees, water towers, whatever is in your neighborhood. You may have to run a piece of 40-gauge wire out there to make it transparent, because you're using somebody else's support, so to speak. The only main advice I tell you along these lines is make sure you're not coming anywhere near any power line when you're putting up stealthy antennas. When you're putting up an invisible antenna, do avoid the power lines. They can get you in a lot of trouble. Anyone with any further comments on Joe's original question or anything else, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. I live on the fourth floor over here. It's a six-story building. I live on the fourth floor. This is KC2QIW for ID. And the roof is all flat. But my question to you, Dick, is there's no trees up there, so I don't know how am I going to do that. How am I going to... I guess they might have, poles up there for the vent to vent out the... I don't know what they're called, but there's like a lot of poles up there on the roof. But the whole roof is flat, by the way, to let you guys know.
40-meter dipole will work on 15 meters.
I agree with that. As long as your roof doesn't have copper sheeting under it, which would act as a bit of a ground plane and would give you a little bit of grief, and as long as you can make a good arrangement with the supervisor of the building, if you and the super can hit it off and you give him a nuisance fee or whatever, and he allows you to install antennas on that roof, dipoles and whatever, between the parapet, around the perimeter of the roof, or using those vent pipes, or maybe even U-bolting a slightly taller aluminum rod or aluminum tubing to a vent pipe so your dipoles will look further up the roof, to put antennas on that roof, as long as you can get permission. Rather easy, and you'll get some nice performance. Six stories up makes you about 75 feet off the ground, even before you start any extra altitude on that roof. That'll give you some very nice antennas. When you're on the fourth floor, that means your apartment is 40 feet or 50 feet above the ground. You could, in theory, string a vertical dipole out the window of the building. And if you had a balcony on your apartment to make a helical-fed ground plane vertical half-wave antenna using just the railing, the safety railing of the balcony as the counterpoise, the thing you mechanically mount it to, and that's what the signal pushes against as far as launching current in the antenna is concerned, as long as the antenna is a half-wave electronic resonator, which means it takes very little current to feed it, then just the safety railing would be enough of a ground plane. And there were a lot of guys with New York City apartments running very simple helical wound vertical antennas off their balcony, and they're getting very good performance. But hanging dipole from your balcony, dipole from your window, over to other buildings, vertically down the building. I mean, another possibility is to simply go to the roof, drop a dipole over the edge of the roof, over the parapet, where the center of the dipole goes by your window at the fourth floor, and the rest of the dipole goes further down with a weight on it. The one thing wrong with that thing is on a windy day, the weight's going to swing, and it's going to slam against the building. You've got to do something to bind the bottom of it. And some kind of a simple monofilament line down there can solve that problem. So there's various ways. You read the right kind of books, and you'll find all kinds of ways you can hide antennas in flagpoles, in the rain spout guttering, down the side of the building with 40-gauge wire or 30-gauge wire. You can't see it. On the roof itself, there's a zillion ways you can put up simple dipole-like antennas, and they're going to give you a lot of performance. Anybody have any comments on this? Give me your call letters right now. So your biggest requirement is to decide how you're going to do it and to make friends with the supervisor so that he gives you permission to put these things on the roof. And people have done it without permission. His life gets a little bit more complicated. With his permission, it helps. And, of course, you're going to tell him if anybody has a complaint about the appearance or the or television interference or whatever, you'll put on filters, you'll declare quiet hours until you solve the problem. And almost every interference problem is solvable. I mean, somebody may have a really inexpensive brand of wireless telephone that picks up your signal when you're on 20 meters, in which case there's lots of ways of solving that problem. Or it's a wired telephone, and people have talked about buying this inexpensive filter you put into the wire between the telephone and the wall,
so that it doesn't pick up radio signals and your voice doesn't come out of the loudspeaker of the telephone. So telephone interference, television interference, hi-fi interference, they're all solvable problems. So it's a lot of fun to experiment with antennas, even though you're in an urban environment. I recommend you do it. And you're not going to be putting up one antenna, and even though you don't have a whole lot of time, some of these antennas you can install in half an hour. If you do any operating at all, you can install the antenna. A little bit of researching in your free time, you'll eventually find various suggestions on how to do it. But you don't have to stop on one antenna. You put one vertical out the window and one horizontal on the roof and start comparing the results between the two. And depending on who you're talking to, what is the state of the ionosphere, is it night or day, and what direction the guy you're talking to, one antenna is going to behave better than the other for that particular do-so. Okay, for those who have tuned in late, you're listening to the TechNet. This is TechNet number 1145. By the way, Mel and I have gotten the most amount of response and email on a subject that we discussed about 6 months ago called the space elevator. This is where you have graphite-reinforced ribbon that literally goes to a counterweight you hang in space beyond a synchronous orbit altitude, something like 40 or 50,000 miles out. You put this weight, and you got this very sturdy ribbon made out of carbon graphite reinforced material, and the ribbon hangs all the way down to the Earth, and you literally have an elevator that crawls up that ribbon to put things into space without rocket power. Very exciting project that's been studied on the drawing board now for a number of years, and it's going to be a beautiful program this coming Thursday night on that subject. Channel 21, and probably is another time when Channel 13 will show it. But 8 o'clock Sunday night, this coming Thursday night, on Nova Science Now is the name of the program, and the space elevator is going to be covered. I'm not sure if it's a brand new program or a slight repeat, but it's an exciting subject, and so you want to see, put on your calendar, 8 o'clock, Channel 21, UHF Television, this coming Thursday evening, 8 o'clock. And if I search a little bit further in my TV guide, there's probably a time when Channel 13 will show it. Anybody have any further questions on this? Give me a call that is right now.
WS2N, this is Paul Dick.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that show's also going to be on Tuesday on 13 at the same time, 8 o'clock. Excellent show. And my guess is it's not a repeat. They've been running all new shows recently. Today.
Okay, so 2 o'clock, there we go. Tuesday, 8 o'clock, Channel 13. Thursday, 8 o'clock, Channel 21. Nova Science Now, Space Elevator. Don't miss it. If they do pull that off, boy, that's going to be an exciting project. Right now, when you put something in orbit by way of the space shuttle or some other kind of a non-reusable vehicle, particularly a synchronous orbit satellite, you spend a couple of $100 million launching it into orbit. You got this huge rocket. You got all kinds of zillions of pounds of rocket fuel, be it solid, liquid, gas, whatever, to get it into orbit. A very expensive, elaborate process. The space elevator promises to get hardware into space at 1/100th or 1/1000th the price. And so not easy to establish this thing in the first place. It's got a couple of vulnerabilities. But we've all made jokes over the years about a skyhook. You literally got an anchor in the sky, and you hold yourself up on that rope. That's literally what this project is. And once they do put one up, not if, but when they do put one up, I see no reason why they're going to stop at one. I think there's going to be one in Europe, there's going to be one on the East Coast of the United States, and one on the West Coast, and one in Hawaii, and one in Japan. The idea is so exciting, and we all want to put things into space inexpensively. And that's a great way of doing it. And eventually you're going to be hauling not only hardware, but people with that matter. And so right now, you want to be a guest on the International Space Station, you better have something like $20 million that you're willing to spend to get your tail up there for, let's say, a week at a time. With that space elevator, running at 1/100th or 1/1000th the cost, taking a vacation in space becomes a lot more feasible. And talk to any astronaut that has ever been above the atmosphere of the Earth and looked down. Apparently it's an extremely exciting picture. You just wouldn't believe what it looks like. Picture of being in an airliner on a super clear day when there's not a cloud in the sky, and you can really see everything on the ground or in the ocean or whatever, in the shape of the land that you're driving over. That's kind of exciting. And even those windows in that airliner are tinted and they're scratched, and you don't get anywhere near as good a view as you're going to get when you get into space and you look down. Anybody have any further comments on this? K2LIW and the TechNet. Okay.